This week in Retronauts, we're gonna hop, skip, and jump through history. Hi, everyone. I am Jeremy Parrish, and you are listening to Lucky Episode 777 of Retronauts. That's right, 777. I was going to be fun and cool and put together a casino games episode for this occasion, but I did not do that. So instead, you have to listen to us talk about Capcom platformers, because that's actually more fun and interesting. This is a follow-up to episode, I believe, 693, which was recorded last year at Midwest Gaming Classic, the first of many episodes, or several episodes, trekking through different genres within Capcom's history. That was the vertical shooter episode. This is the platformer episode, which is actually kind of almost sort of connected to the shooter space of Capcom, because a lot of these early platformers kind of started out as like horizontal shooters where you also have a guy who can jump. So I kind of feel like there's some kindred there. And interestingly enough, because we were just talking about him, that previous episode featured one Brian Clark. How about that, Stuart?
Sorry, who? No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Oh, my God.
It's an in-joke. That's an in-joke.
Betrayal. Betrayal. Oh, yeah. So sad.
That's an in-joke.
So, wait, who are you?
Oh, I'm Diamond Fight, hailing from... okay. It's me. It's Stuart Chip. You can tell because of my annoying voice. But hello. I just wanted to say, actually, that not doing a gambling-based episode, A, the right thing to do because gambling is wrong, and B, by not doing the obvious thing, you are sort of doing a gamble. So it works either way. No matter what you do, you win. Yeah.
Wow. So I'm doing the wrong thing because I'm gambling.
Well, you're doing the right thing because you're winning.
So it doesn't matter what you do as long as you win.
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely the case. Yeah.
That's the ultimate justification.
Yeah, yeah.
So now we understand Stuart's morality. Before this episode, Stuart was talking about how he likes not having any agency because in life, because then he doesn't have to take accountability for things. So that's like one step removed from I was just following orders. So we're getting a good bead on Stuart's morality, his ethical compass.
I'm going to challenge that comparison because I don't really like following orders, but I also don't really like receiving orders at all. So what I really want to do is have absolutely no responsibility.
Basically to sequester yourself from the universe.
Yeah, ideally I would just sort of exist. And honestly, even that is an imposition.
Fair enough. Okay, I apologize for my slander. And finally, we do have another guest this episode, a friend of Capcom, a friend of Retronauts. So therefore, by I feel like by transitive property, that means that Retronauts is a friend of Capcom. So that's great news for us, but please introduce yourself.
Yeah, Patrick Kulikowski. I think the last time you heard my voice was during the Breath of Fire 3 and 4 podcast aeons ago. I can't even remember what year that was.
they're all the same at this point. So it was sometime before right now.
Yeah.
So therefore eligible for Retronauts coverage.
Sounds good to me.
So we can have a great retrospective on that episode right now if you want.
I do have to say, I think this episode will serve a great purpose in just dusting off cobwebs on Capcom platformers, because there's some things that, you know, I played a lot of the ones that we're going to talk about, but it's also like, what was in that one again? it'll be fun to revisit.
I feel like Capcom kind of stopped making platformers sometime in the 1990s. And really after that, you got like some Ghosts and Goblins sequels and some Mega Man sequels.
And that Bionic Commando remake, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so it was either like dusting off old properties or continuing old properties. I guess there was also, you can kind of consider Beautiful Joe a platformer, but it's also not. It's like a platformer in the treasure sense where it's like, yeah, this is kind of looks like one genre, but then you play it and it's this other thing. So you're like wrong.
Beat 'em up action. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot going on.
It's there. One of those games where every 30 seconds it tells you how bad you suck at it.
Maybe that's why I never finished it.
That's also Mega Man ZX. Or no, sorry, Mega Man Zero. Ooh, especially the true. Original. That's that true. Game yeah. was just like, wow, why did you even bother playing? You beat this boss and took one piece of damage, and you beat it in like 3 seconds over the best possible time. You might as well just kill yourself, you loser.
That game is
really dispiriting.
I've told the director of Mega Man Zero, Yoshinori Kawano, that, yeah. Oh, yeah, I played that back when it came out. Never finished. Just way too hard.
And it let you know that you sucked too bad to play.
Yeah.
Oh, you used many of the tools that we gave you at your disposal to be able to complete the game? Wow, you absolute loser. What's your problem? It's crazy. Yeah.
In order to make sort of headway, you have to just ignore most of the systems available to you, which is... And I love that game. My hands up, but... Yeah.
They heard people complaining about the charge shot in Mega Man 4 and how it like kind of broke the game. So they were like, well, we're going to give you something that's equally useful, but if you use it, you'll get the worst possible results for the game. And we'll just remind you at the end of every stage that you're trash.
Oh, boy.
We're also going to give you the charge shot, but you have to unlock it by hitting enemies a certain number of times. They didn't nail it right out the gate with that series.
Very grindy, yeah.
But I think Mega Man Zero is more like Nadia's space to talk about, so I won't step on her toes. We're going to talk about a lot of games that have been covered in various capacities on Retronauts, so some of those we're not going to go into immense depth on. Perhaps we do not need, at this moment in time, to give you an in-depth discussion on Mega Man. That may have been touched on once or twice on Retronauts, but there are lots of other platformers here, you know, digging back through the 80s and 90s, I found a pretty solid number of platform action games before Capcom kind of said, let's go in another direction. And I think the other direction was basically Resident Evil with a bit of Devil May Cry. And those kind of took the place of platform games in their action lineup. So... yeah, traditional 2D platformers kind of fell by the wayside, and Capcom really didn't make 3D platformers besides, I guess, Maximo?
And that was like a production studio 8, like the USA dev studio that once existed.
Yeah, weren't they the ones who also gave us Final Fight Revenge?
Streetwise. Oh, yeah, technically Streetwise. Revenge oh, Streetwise. And Streetwise, yeah.
I'm thinking the Saturn game that was made in America that everyone hates.
Who, my director at my current job was one of the producers and composer of that game. That's
oh, no kidding. Everyone loves that game. It's so good. And you can let them know that we play it daily and just in its existence.
He's well aware of how it panned out.
I will Capcom, I'm going to give them mild credit because they kind of did bring 2D action back in a way with Mega Man 9. They were like, I think, one of the earliest to kind of just go, hey, let's make another NES game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great game.
Yeah.
And that ties in with Mega Man Zero by way of Mega Man ZX by way of Mega Man Alpha. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we might get there. We might not. But there's a lot to work through here in the 1980s. 80s, 80s. So we can do that. We can look back into the past. So, the thing, like I mentioned at the outset, the thing about Capcom platformers is that sometimes it's kind of hard to draw a hard line between what for Capcom is a platformer and what is a shooter. So, we're going to start with a game called Sunsun, which is that a shooter? Is that a platformer? What the hell is that? Stuart Jip, walk us through it.
I really like Sunsun. I first played this on Capcom Generations on the PS1, and I'd never heard of it, and it just immediately grabbed me. It's okay. How can I explain this? I sort of see it as a combination of Do you know Root Beer Tapper? Is that the name of the game?
It's just called Tapper for us grown-ups. Okay.
Because you're just like, you're moving between lanes, up and down, like just solid lanes. I can't think of a better way to describe it besides Tapper, because that's what you do in Tapper. You go between lanes. And it's a little bit like that, except you're also shooting to the left or right, maybe just to the right, actually, I forget. Enemies are coming onto the screen, and it's like a stack of platforms, like something out of maybe Bubble Bobble, except they're crossing most of the screen. There's just a few gaps in them. You don't really do any platforming, as in jumping over bottomless pits. It's just to avoid, you're pressing up or down to drop between or move up one layer. And as you run, you'll be assaulted by kind of shmup-esque formations of enemies. Some of them are on foot and fire back at you. Some of them are flying in like a parabola, that kind of thing. And every so often you'll come to like a, I guess you'd call it like an outpost where the game will stop scrolling. You have to defeat a certain number of enemies or break through their shields, and then the game will keep scrolling. And as you're going, you're collecting things like fruit. There are secret bamboo things that when you run over certain spots, they'll sprout out of the ground and they give you big point bonuses. And I think it's based on Journey to the West.
Yeah.
And it has the same opening as Ghosts and Goblins, where something swoops down and pinches your girlfriend and flies off, I believe. It's just literally the same. And I can't think of anything else to say about Sonsong, so I'm pretty sure that is actually it in its totality.
Yeah, I think it's a fun pick-up-and-play sort of game. It's got very cute key art, too. In terms of depth, I don't know if there's much to say in that regard, and it does get kind of repetitive, so I never really gave it more than, like, 10-15 minutes at a time anytime I jumped into it, but it was fun.
It's fun with another person, I think, because you can, you know, co-op your way through the game. But yeah, I think 10-15 minutes is a fair amount of time to spend with it in a session, because I can't usually live that long in the game anyway.
Right.
It's tough. It's quite hard. It's an arcade game. It's quite difficult, but I don't think it's like painfully difficult, which is what makes it appealing for me. It's actually quite playable, and the rules are very, you can see a lot of the screen, like, at once. You're not getting jumped. You can see everything. You just have to have the multitasking skill to be like, oh, there are guys here, they're going to be doing this, I can do this, it will keep me alive. But
yeah, the finesse. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. It's good. I like it. And I think it's on Arcade Stadium, as are quite a lot of these games. So give it a go.
It's on Second Stadium. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
So just to kind of get back to the roots of Sonsong, besides Journey to the West, because, you know, so many games are based on Journey to the West. You play as a little monkey guy who is probably named Goku or Son Goku. And I would say this game kind of builds on the single screen platformer of the early 1980s. This is from 1984 and kind of feels like they were attempting to evolve like the Donkey Kong concept in their own way. So, or, you know, the visuals, if you look at them, they have kind of a feel that's reminiscent of those games from oh so long ago, or something like Balloon Fight. But basically, you know, as Stuart said, there's lanes, but it's like, you know, stacked platforms, basically just like long lines that you can run through, and you can jump up and down. I feel like there is something that I've played that is like this, and it's eluding me at the moment. It also plays a little bit like, what do you call it? Psycho Soldier by Crosstown Rivals SNK. So as the screen scrolls automatically, yeah, you're just like facing things that pop up, and you have like five or six platform levels that you can jump up and down and travel between. It kind of actually has kind of like the feel of like an LCD game or something, like a Game & Watch. You could, I think, translate this game really, really easily into a Game & Watch. It's that simple. But, you know, because it's Capcom, it does have a lot of fun little features. But this was one of their very first games, like second or third.
Yeah, after Vulgus
and Exit X's. So they were still kind of figuring things out. And this game has largely been supplanted in history by the fact that all people really know of Sonsong now is the character Sonsong, who was given a rule, is it rule 34, 42? I can't remember. I don't know. A gender swap, basically, and turned into a cute monkey girl for Marvel vs. Capcom 2. And sometimes she could turn into a giant ape and, you know, smash things on the screen, just like Son Goku in Dragon Ball. So kind of tying it into the grand universe of Journey to the West adventures, I guess. I don't know. Anyway,
they know them from that. They don't know them from Sun Sun 2 on the PC Engine, because nobody knows that one or has played it.
That is correct. That did not come to the US. So why would anyone know it? Because we only play games that are made and released in America, as we are red-blooded Americans plus two.
It's funny. I completely blanked on the fact that Sun Sun is in MVC 2. But what I think of is the fun little cameo in Super Gem Fighter, where there's one level where Sun Sun's just in the cloud, like hovering over, and you can like jump up and smack it for like an orb or an item to use during combat. And I always thought that was a cute little homage.
You know, I've never played Gem Fighters. I've played Puzzle Fighter, but never Gem Fighters.
It's a really fun one. It's in the Capcom Fighting Collection, the first one. Super fun.
I didn't buy that, so that's on me.
Fair.
I think it's also in Stadium 2, but I could be mistaken. Probably.
Oh, yeah. It was a strange period where the Fighting Collection came out, and then it was like, hey, let's put these in Arcade Second Stadium as well. It's like, oh, okay. Two ways to get it, I guess.
So, Stuart, you said that Sun Sun is not very difficult. Capcom was still figuring things out. But you'll be happy to know that the next game on this list, they figured it out.
Next
game on this list is Ghosts and Goblins, a game that lives in infamy because no one has ever finished it. And if they say they have, they're lying. Or at least they haven't finished it twice, which is how you actually beat the game.
I finished it, but...
You're lying.
But, big but here, the one time I had to use a save state in Capcom Arcade Stadium was right before the double Satan fight, the second go-around of it. Which is the penultimate final boss. Two of those Satan enemies on the same platform, and you're like climbing up to them, and you have to defeat them with that goddess bracelet, and it's so brutal. I had to like keep reloading. I didn't save scum it per se, but just the start of the battle and retrying over and over because, I was losing all hope at that point.
So this is really one of those games that blurs the line between platformer and shooter. You know, at the time that this came out, September 1985 in arcades, there were not a lot of platform action games in the world, at least in the way we think of them. This was the same month that Super Mario Brothers came out on Famicom and basically kind of locked down the workings of the genre. But before this, it was stuff like Pac-Land and... You know, there was like a Snoopy game on the Tomiputa and just like some really random stuff. If you did have kind of platformy type games, they tended to be like Pitfall and they were, you know, flip screen as opposed to continuously scrolling. So Ghosts and Goblins was really kind of breaking new ground. And I feel like it got there by drawing a lot from the shooter genre. So you've got a guy who from the very start, one, he can take an extra hit, which is cool. Like, it's not like Sonic where you have to go find a ring. You just take a hit. You're golden. And you're running around in your underwear, but still you're golden. It's that suntan. but from the outset, you chuck things. You have an infinite supply of, at the beginning, lances, but you can pick up other weapons like daggers and flames and axes, maybe not the first game, but
yeah, not axes.
Also a goddess bracelet, crosses. So, you know, it really is about ranged combat. It's really, the platforming is very rigid. And I feel like that is by design because it forces you to think. You can't just like run around like Mario can. You really have to think about what you're doing, what your relationship to other enemy or other characters on screen is. You have to be mindful of the fact that in a lot of spaces, enemies materialize out of nowhere. So there is kind of like this risk and commitment element to jumping in Ghosts and Goblins that helps make it very, very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, like, with respect to the legacy of this game, because I do love the sequels, I don't think I would really want to beat this game twice or once even. I'm probably just salty because I get to the red armor after the first, 30 seconds of level one.
Yeah.
And then it really does feel like, if that guy feels like letting me past, he will. Because I've never managed to clock those guys, consistently. And it really does kind of feel like the game is giving me a big middle finger.
I think the Red Aramur is the true villain of Ghosts and Goblins. Like, forget the one who kidnapped the girlfriend and all that stuff. It's really him.
But I mean, I will get to them. But I think that this was as necessary to have this to get Ghouls and Ghosts and Super Ghouls and Ghosts, which I love to death. Mm-hmm. But this one, I just feel like I think you're getting kind of the worst aspects of something like Castlevania, which I know timeline wise doesn't sort of line up right, but the sort of how rigid
Castlevania took so much from this game.
Yeah, but how rigid it is. For Castlevania, it worked, and for this, I just feel like it's already so hard. Couldn't you just let me turn in midair or something? It's brutal, really, really unrelentingly difficult, and it's in a way that to me, I'm probably wrong. It feels like sometimes if the game decides no, this is not going to be a formation that you can deal with in certain levels, it's just really frustrating, really, really frustrating, which isn't something I feel about the later ones, as hard as they are. I always feels like, oh, I messed up. And this, it's like, oh, they didn't want me going up that ladder.
Clearly.
The music's good. I like the music.
Great music. The setting is really cool. The fact that you have to commit to your jumps, there's no way around that. There's no control. Once you jump, that's it. It's definitely brutal. I got some satisfaction at just being able to complete it level to level. But it's also, if you're a glutton for punishment, this is your game.
In a sense. It's one of those games that has checkpoints, and every time you get to a new checkpoint and that's where you start continuing, you're like, I feel like I made it. But then, whatever is beyond that checkpoint is even harder than what came before. So it's also very demoralizing. I feel like the thing that makes Ghosts and Goblins more challenging than Castlevania is that Castlevania is very consistent and very kind of defined about the challenges it puts in front of you. Even when there are infinitely spawning enemies like Medusas or eagles dropping little monk guys, you still know, this is what I'm going to face in this section, and it's going to behave like this. And Ghosts and Goblins, you go into an area, you are going to face specific enemies, and they're going to be, in certain places, but how they appear randomly is much less, I would say, forgiving than in Castlevania. In Castlevania, they always spawn from off screen. So, you see them coming in and you have a chance to react. In Ghosts and Goblins, little demon guys or tornadoes or whatever will just kind of pop up in midair, while you're in the middle of a jump, and there's no way to predict that. And that makes it really, really hard. I see what you're saying, Stuart, about how the game, it's like it decides, I'm going to let you win this time, but now I've decided that, I'm just going to hit you with something you could not have predicted. There was no way to avoid. And every, each level is basically divided into half. And each half of a game has a set number of challenges, but, how those spawn and even how they behave. Some of the bigger humanoid enemies that take a lot of hits to kill, from red armors to unicorns to those, ogre-looking guys and the castle ruins that you have to climb, they all behave very erratically, and they have certain behaviors, certain program patterns. But they don't, they don't execute those consistently. And it almost, going back to the shooter, it kind of feels like the designers took some inspiration from Namco Zevius, which is a game where, as you fly along, the longer you survive, the more challenging enemy waves become. And when you die, it resets everything. But there is kind of a consistency in the kind of enemies that appear in Zevius, but they don't always appear from the same spot. It's not like you know, something like Galaga, where, you know, the enemies are always going to come in waves and there's not really any surprise about where they come from. And you can kind of, you know, plan around their appearance. In Zevius, it's like, you don't know exactly where enemies are going to spawn. And, you know, once you get to the Andor Genesis boss at the end of the main loop, things are just popping up in midair. And it's really hard to predict where they're going to materialize. And they may materialize directly under you while you're trying to line up a shot. Ghosts and Goblins feels like it takes a lot from that, which wouldn't be surprising given how popular that game was at the time in Japan. I could see it having some influence. But, you know, applying that to a platform action shooter context as opposed to a pure shooter makes for something that's really challenging because, you know, navigating space with while dealing with gravity, I guess, you know, and having to jump and climb in addition to just moving around like you do in a shooter, that takes more concentration and more planning and is just, you know, it requires a different skill set than a pure shooter. So, you know, I feel like they were trying to up the ante and they upped it maybe a little too high.
And if you get knocked into the torch or that fire weapon, all bets are off. Forget about successfully completing the remainder of that level until you get the lance or the dagger back.
Yeah, the freaking fire. Trying to fight the red armor who like hovers around above you with a weapon that has like this tiny little 5-pixel arc upward and then hits the ground. That's a lot of fun. I love that. Thank you. Thank you, programmers.
To add more insult to injury, you can that magician can appear that transforms Arthur into like a defenseless, temporary, useless character where you just have to kind of avoid enemies until you regain your form too. So
is the magician in the first one?
I believe he's in there. I forget what he transforms Arthur into though. I think it's like a frog or something like that.
That sounds right. And in the second one he transforms him into like a baby and
a
duck. Yeah.
the real challenge with the red armor, besides, you know, either avoiding him, although he likes to chase you around, is getting him to turn into the white armor, which you have to survive in a fight with him for over a minute without killing him or him killing you.
No happening.
What does that do? What happens when he turns in, when he turns white?
He gets more aggro. He doesn't increase.
Oh, good.
Like he's not weaker, stronger or anything, but he just gets more aggro with you. It's a fun little like Easter egg, but it's also like, why? Why would you want this?
For me with the red armor, what always gets me about it is it's not just that the red armor is difficult, though it is. It's that he's difficult in a really annoying way, which is you get a shot and he just kind of jukes it. He's like, nope, nope, not this time. It's like,
and that's kind of why I feel like there's some Zevius influence here, because a lot of the ships in Zevius will fly at you. But then as soon as they sort of cross your line of fire, they peel away and dart off screen. And he does exactly that. Like, you line up a shot for him and you're like, yes, I'm going to stick this lance in his face. And then he, you know,
floats up right away,
you know, at the last second before your lance actually makes, you know, connects.
I love the fact that his name was derived from the lead programmer for Ghosts and Goblins, Toshio Arima, and the head guy, Tokuro Fujiwara, named it after him because of his, like, I guess, fiery personality. So in a sense, Red Armor is like a caricature of the lead programmer of this game, which is pretty funny.
That explains a lot.
I think Fujiwara's game design philosophy definitely is like ways to trick the player or, you know, infuriate them.
Oh man, you think I'd love this, but no.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought up Tokuro Fujiwara because that was the next thing I wanted to talk about. So many of these early Capcom platform games are in some capacity, the work of Tokuro Fujiwara. He was either the designer and director, or he produced them, or he worked on artwork or whatever. You can always tell when he's been involved in a game because they have this very distinct look. Like if you look at the characters in Ghost and Goblins, Bionic Commando, Willow for arcades, there was one other one, Strider.
Yeah,
like
Strider.
there is a consistency with the character design, and it's very much like you just look at it and you're like, that's that same guy. That same guy designed all of these. And I really got a great look at it with Tomba. You know, when we republished Tomba at Limited Run Games, Stuart and I collaborated on a guide and art book, and laying out the art book, the entire, like all the sketch work, the level design sketches and stuff for the game were very, very clearly drawn by Fujiwara. Like there's so much like character design artwork, poses, expressions, and then like level layouts. He drew that all by hand, and it's so distinctly his style. And there is a lot of like, oh, you know, the game likes to trick you, but it's less cruel in Tomba and more like, you know, now here's an opportunity for more adventure. Whereas in his arcade games, it was much more like basically screw you. Like you have to put in another quarter now. But there is like this fingerprint of design on so many of Capcom's platformers. And, you know, even with something like Mega Man that he didn't design, he produced that. He was kind of overseeing the creation of it. It's kind of hard to talk about Capcom platformers without talking about Fujiwara. And I feel like he is someone who's had a really big influence on platform game design. Even though I don't know that he necessarily gets a lot of credit for it, people like will associate him with Ghosts and Goblins and say, wow, he's a mean bastard. But I just feel like there's like so many of the games he worked on were just super influential and really kind of defined how this entire genre works. So I just wanted to stop and give a shout out to this man, even though he did create the Ghost and Goblins series, and it makes me sad and angry. I still have a lot of respect for him because he, like, just his ideas and his approach and his aesthetics were very, very influential on future games that came along. Even if, you know, they weren't necessarily the games that people were trying to match, you know, like Super Mario Brothers had the sales and people were trying to do the new Super Mario Brothers or whatever. But, you know, people were taking notes from him for sure.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear about him from other, you know, former Capcom Japan folks. I think Shinji Mikami in one interview described him as very scary in the fact that there is no, I can't do this, only yes, you can do this. On top of that, I've also heard that he was infamous in rejecting folks' work. So if they, you know, took weeks or days to put something together, and you know, back then it was all kind of more dictatorial, like what the top chef says, you know, the thumbs up or thumbs down he gives, that's that, and there's no way around it. And he was notorious for rejecting people's concepts and designs and stuff, and basically, no, do this again. And that was always a nightmare for developers at Capcom Japan.
So he treated his team like he treated players, basically.
In a sense, I guess, yeah.
Okay. Not surprising.
Still took their input, of course, though. Yeah.
Sure. Just like he still took people's quarters. Yeah.
Yeah, quarter muncher for sure.
So anyway, thanks Fujiwara for making us all a little more frustrated, a little more sad about life. So the next game I want to talk about is, in fact, a Fujiwara game. Speaking about the arcade version, I notice that Patrick, you kind of blended some things together in the notes, but specifically I'm talking about Bionic Commando in the arcade, which came out in 1986. And that was, you know, like you look at that one, it's definitely a Fujiwara game. Like you look at the character designs, straight up just Fujiwara guys. It's like Arthur and the Red Armor, but now they're, you know, instead of being a knight and a demon, they're a soldier and, I don't know, another soldier, but more Nazi coded. Bionic Commando is also very difficult, but I feel like the original arcade version was super influential on, specifically on like European microcomputer design, because this is kind of the game that introduced the idea of big open spaces that you have to navigate, and you have a lot of pathways through it. And some are more difficult than others, and you just kind of have to figure things out. But also, no matter which way you go, there's always going to be something that is there waiting for you to dick you over as soon as you get to where you're trying to get to. Do you think that's fair, Stuart? I feel like Bionic Commando made its way to a lot, like in its original arcade incarnation, to a lot of systems that were popular in Europe and pretty quickly too. So I just feel like so many of those games that came after were kind of looking to Bionic Commando for inspiration.
I know Bionic Commando from, you guessed it, from the Spectrum version, but it would be impossible for me to say whether or not that was actually kind of like good. That does have the big open sort of stages, but it also has this kind of not really flick screen, but like you only see one screen at a time and then it will just scroll across. The original like arcade Bionic Commando has kind of eluded me in many ways, and I have played it. And I remember playing it when I was a very small child, at the seaside, or the beach, as you would call it in the United States of America. And the whole not being able to jump thing is just a complete like turn off for me. I just can't into it, even in like the more modern ones, even in the NES one. I just cannot like deal with that. It's not right. It's like I thought that Arthur with his very small jump was bad, but now no jump at all. I mean, honestly, it's difficult for me to say with regards to the micro sort of stage design. I mean, honestly, I don't see it. I'm not saying you're wrong, but I just personally, I don't see it. But then again, I think that might be because I'm used to that from those games, not from this game, if that makes sense. I don't really know what the timeline is for a lot of the games that I played on.
Well, can you name some games that, you know, that you're thinking of?
The problem is they'd be meaningless. I could name Count Duckula in No Sax Please We're Egyptian, because that's what comes to mind when I think of that kind of big open space. And that means nothing to anyone but me, you know? it's really difficult to say. It makes me think more of stuff like, I don't know, something like Pitfall 2 maybe comes to mind, but even that is very different.
Yeah, no, I feel like maybe not on Spectrum, but the thing that does make Bionic Commando different from so many other games is that it does have free scrolling in all directions.
Right.
And, you know, that was pretty unseen at the time. You know, we're talking like a year after Ghosts and Goblins and Super Mario Brothers and, you know, what else did you have out there? Like Adventure or Wonder Boy? Like people were still just figuring out what does it mean when a little guy like runs and jumps? What is that? I feel like it was very, very kind of, you know, put a flag in new territory in terms of just the technology of game design.
It is pretty ballsy to, like 1 or 2 years after Mario and Ghosts and Goblins to go take the jump away. Let's make it even harder. But for some, it did the opposite for me. I loved the limitation of no jumping, but of course the game was designed around swinging around and latching on to things, so it felt very satisfying.
According to GameFAQs, Count Duckula in No Sax Please We're Egyptian was a 1989 game. So
oh, okay.
3 years later. How about that? Oh, something to think about, something to consider in those long, sleepless nights. The thing is, I don't think Bionic Commando in the arcade did a great job with the no jumping thing. Mm. I do think the NES version really nailed it. And part of what makes the NES version great, as opposed to like, oh, this is interesting and not very fun, is that they changed the dynamic of the bionic arm so that when you press the grappling button without pressing any other direction, on NES, you fire the arm forward at 45 degrees. So it's like forward right. and up. Mm-hmm. In the arcade game, you normally fire it straight forward. And then if you want to fire it in, you know, straight up or at a 45 degree angle, you have to press the controller in one of those directions. And trying to press a diagonal and, you know, fling out a grappling arm and then deal with the fact that this is your replacement for jumping while also shooting and dodging things from every direction is a little frustrating. It's a little too difficult, in my opinion. It's just a little too much to deal with. Right. But when they simply automate the process of firing at a 45 degree angle, it really changes things because the 45 degree angle is kind of how you get mobility. Like you can grapple directly upward if you want to climb, and you can grapple directly forward if you want to like hit something or block a bullet or, you know, grab onto something and pull yourself close. But mobility in Bionic Commando is really grappling at a 45 degree angle, latching onto something, then pressing the grapple button again to kind of kick off from the ground and swing forward. And it took me, you know, when I borrowed that from a friend when it first came out, it took me like a night of playing and being like, what is this? To kind of get my head around it. But then the next day I woke up, played it again and beat the game. It just like,
nice.
After wrestling with it a little bit, I got it. And I feel like it's a really great mechanic in that one game. And I don't feel like anyone else has ever really quite mastered it aside from, you know, like the remakes. But even then, like, you know, Elite Forces on Game Boy Color didn't quite have it. And I think that's because the sprites were a little too big for the screen and also
yeah, chunky.
a little too much animation, which kind of slowed things down. There's an immediacy to Bionic Commando on NES that really is, it's essential to the game because, you know, grappling is your jump replacement. So it needs to be quick, instantaneous, thought, you know, effortless, no thought into it. It's just, you know, a quick reaction, basically an instinct. And I think the NES game manages that. And the other versions tend not to be as good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was the satisfaction of like, there were so many moments where you could save yourself from a bottomless pit death by just latching onto something last minute and pulling yourself up, which was a lot of the thrill of that. And then of course, eventually gain the ability to like, well, I guess this is more in the remake where you can grab enemies and throw them. I don't think the NES version had that, but
no, if you hit an enemy with your grappling arm and on the NES version, they just
pushes them.
Knocks them backward. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. To this day, I think the NES Bionic Commando is probably my favorite Capcom platformer on the NES. Something about that swing is just super satisfying to me. And you're right. I don't think any other series has quite perfected it in that or evolved it in that way. So
I keep dreaming of it, but we're not quite there.
Yeah.
But someday. The arcade game, not quite there.
Yeah. Never finished that. It's too hard. Some ways I think it's harder than Ghosts and Goblins. I don't know if that's
objectively
true.
I think in a sense, the arcade Bionic Commando, from my experience with it, is it's not only that you are having to learn. I mean, I know you can learn this and that's not a problem anymore, but you have to deal with these controls at the same time as really just being kind of swarmed in the same sort of way that you are in Ghosts and Goblins.
Very true.
Whereas the NES game, which I'm going to hold my hands up here, this is one that for some reason eludes me, and I'm really looking forward to the day it doesn't. It seems clear to me that in the NES game, even from my time with it, everything you do is always going to work out the same way, if that makes sense. It's always very methodical. It's like, if you do this, it will latch on in this way. And then if you press the button again, you will pull yourself up. If you press the button again while you're swinging, you will release. It's all very learnable. You know, you can pick it up and then I would be able to make progress. But I haven't done that. And that means that I get to enjoy this someday. So I'm kind of hyped for that, to be honest.
Yeah, it's funny. I never finished the NES Bionic Commando, despite it being one of my favorites, simply for the fact that I ran out of lives and continues at the like penultimate level, and that just killed my spirit. But this is
also, you gotta go fight those guys on the ground.
Yeah,
and it's gotta pretend you're Super Joe in Commando. Yeah,
and it's funny though, because like the game's kind of long if you think about it. I mean, all the levels are laid out on that map from the beginning, but there is some like backtracking, and there's like different areas where you have to collect items to move forward to subsequent levels. But it's one of those games that I sincerely feel should have had a password system at the very least.
Yeah, it's a little long the first time through for not having a password. But then again, so is Super Mario Brothers 3, and people love that one. So
true.
What do we know?
It's. I mean, speaking in terms of sort of the Capcom platformer lineage, I mean, with the Bionic Commando, it gets us to, like, I mean, in a way, it gets us to Strider and the clambering all over every kind of surface. But it also, I mean, it even turns up in, like, Mickey Mouse Magical Quest. You get pretty much the grappling hook towards the end of that, I believe. And you can do some really crazy, fancy things with that. So, I mean, yeah, it's all here, you know, and they're iterating on it as we go. And we're going to see a lot of the elements of this game again, particularly the NES version. Like, I mean, the map doesn't seem a million miles from something like Mega Man or DuckTales choosing a stage to tackle next. You know, it seems like we're getting there.
I mean, it's straight up Super Mario Brothers 3.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah. Mm.
But, you know, they came out in Japan like 4 months apart. So it's just one of those, like, everyone kind of landed on the same idea at the same time. And it's a really good idea. So, I like it. So next up, another game that I feel like this one was also worked on by Fujiwara. I could be wrong, but I don't want to talk about it too much because I want to hold it for the next conversation, which is the Capcom Barbarian Legacy. And this is Black Tiger. But I do think Black Tiger is worth mentioning here because it's not really that much of a platformer compared to Ghosts and Goblins or Mega Man, but it does have a lot of platforming in it. It's very much a game designed in the vein of Rygar or Rasten Saga, although I think it predates Rasten. But you're like a beefy dude and you're fighting through hordes of monsters and caves and, you know, just going on an adventure. But it has that kind of like Bionic Commando, multi-scrolling, you know, all-directional scrolling to it. But at the same time, it's also kind of a shooter because unlike all the other Barbarian games along that I mentioned, like Rygar and whatever, you don't have like a tiny short range attack, or you're not like beating some dude with a melee strike or a sword or something. You've got this long ass flail that goes like halfway across the screen. And at the same time, you can very, very easily get power-ups that allow you to fire like magic beams in kind of like a Contra-esque spread. So it takes just like a minute for you to get like super powered up in Black Tiger, and you are just like this barbarian walking, barreling through enemies and just blasting the entire screen with physical and mystical weapons. It's really remarkable. It's very much an empowering game in the way that you did not see in arcade games of this era.
Yeah, that was a fun one. Never got far in it, but the power-up aspects were fun. I will say it was a Yoshiki Okamoto joint, so it wasn't Fujiwara. But anytime Black Tiger is mentioned, I just think of, oh yeah, that's the first Capcom game to use Zenny as a currency, and that just kickstarted the whole Zenny craze with Capcom games.
Yeah, I would love to sit down and talk to some people who worked on this and games like Wonder Boy in Monster Land, just to say who came up with the idea of an arcade action game where you have to buy stuff, where there's an economy, because these games came out around the same time. I think Black Tiger might have been first, but I guess maybe it's all taken from Fantasy Zone, which was 1985. Mm. where you like shot dudes and coins appeared, and then you'd go into the shop and you'd buy upgrades. But I feel like with Black Tiger and I just totally blanked out, Wonder Boy in Monster Land, like all of a sudden that became a fixture of fantasy games. Like, you're in a fantasy world and it's kind of RPG-ish, and there's always like a shop to go to, so you got to go buy stuff. And that was also very interesting in an arcade game.
It was a staple, like following the same. It was like, I know it's not a platformer, but Forgotten Worlds was the next year, I think, 88, and that has the Zenny, that has the shopping, and then a game that I think is quite similar to Black Tiger that I don't think's on this list we've got here. Mega Twins was that was a Capcom, wasn't it? Cheeky Boys.
That
reminds me as well of Wonder Boy and of Black Tiger in a sense, in the way that you're sort of traveling. Although I don't think it has the all directional scrolling, that one. I think that's a very linear game. But
that one always has struck me more as like a Monster Lair type game, more of a linear shooter as opposed to a all range platformer.
But Black Tiger, I mean, I see the connective tissue from Ghosts and Goblins to Black Tiger to Ghouls and Ghosts. You know, it's, I mean, Ghouls and Ghosts we'll get to, but even that on, I think, the Master System version, that even had a shop, that even had a currency system in there. So they're all merging together. Black Tiger, for me, sorry to bring it up, but there's a Spectrum game called Savage. It's awful, but it's a complete rip-off of Black Tiger, so that's how I mainly know it. It's exactly the same, except bad in every regard.
Sounds like compelling.
No, it's not.
Black Tiger is kind of infamous because it was supposed to have been converted to NES, and they never did that. And I don't know why. But, you know, this was around the same time that they were supposed to do, like, a whole lot of stuff with Strider for NES, and that only came out in the US, and the Japanese version never shipped. So I think, you know, they had a lot of big ideas and they didn't always pan out. They were really kind of swinging for the fences. As you saw in Bionic Commando, which is not a port of the arcade game, it is a full sequel that's greatly expanded and also adds like another entire genre of gameplay. So, you know, Capcom, they were definitely not sitting on their laurels with the NES. They were really always trying to push the limits. And I think Black Tiger, maybe with all the stuff happening on screen and the all direction scrolling and so forth, might have just been a little too much for the NES. But I've always, you know, after having seen previews saying it's coming to NES, it always made me, wonder what could have happened. What might have been? Would they have made that like a direct port, or would it have been another one of those like, hey, we made a sequel effectively to this arcade game you like? I don't know. I played Black Tiger a lot in the arcade back in the day. There was a pizza joint that I would go to for Sunday lunch whenever I visited my family in a different city. And so anytime I saw that, I would just, you know, drop in a few quarters and have a great time. Never really got much of anywhere, but I felt good about it. And that's what really counts with video games. So I was always kind of sad that the NES version never happened.
See, I was confused then because I was convinced this got ported to the SNES, but I must be thinking of something very similar.
You're probably thinking of Magic Sword.
That is almost certainly what I'm thinking of, yeah.
Which though, I did not include here because it's not really a platformer. That's going in the Barbarian Games episode.
Though I will mention, just because I can't think of anywhere else it would be relevant, that the previously mentioned PC Engine Sun Sun 2 is pretty much like a Black Tiger rework. It's like they took the structure of this game and applied it to a completely different former sort of Capcom series. So that's if you want to play a decent-ish port of Black Tiger that isn't just an emulation, then I guess you could check out Sun Sun 2. It's kind of the same.
I guess I know what's going to happen in TurboWorks Gaiden sometime soon, now that I've been informed of this. Thanks.
Hey, no problem. You know my mailing address for the check.
Yes, I make so much money off of my YouTube videos. Sometimes even entire dollars. It's great. So, let's mosey on over to the next game. This one is not an arcade port, not an arcade conversion, not an arcade sequel. It is a wholly original game created for the NES by Capcom, and it was a huge failure. That's right, we're talking about the original Mega Man, the game that no one bought. But it got a sequel anyway because some people got really bored working on a baseball murder mystery, which, you know, that's a pretty good excuse to go above and beyond. But Mega Man, yes, I actually did own this game back in the day because Mega Man 2 looked so cool that I went out and said, I need to own that first game. And it turned out to be better than the box led me to believe. But that's not hard.
Mm. Yeah, this is one of the rare games. I mean, this was the first Mega Man I played because for some reason I had a friend, and for some reason they had a Nintendo, and for some reason they had this. So I remember finding this completely just like bewitching, the blue select screen with the music that just blares out at you. When I was in like formative years, that was really like, oh my God, this is so exciting. Look at all these guys I can pick from, you know, and then you pick Gutsman, you would be able to get past those platforms, but I digress. Obviously this is of the NES games, you could argue this is the weakest link of those, but also it is the most important link. You know, it's without this we don't get Mega Man 2, which is broadly considered one of the very best platformers of all time, accurately I might add, and this adds in your whole pick a stage, pick. I can't think of a game prior to this of this level of popularity that had that sort of approach. There probably are several, but nothing is coming to mind.
You know, some of the early, like, 1980-ish Atari games, they didn't exactly have that, but they would let you pick a difficulty level determining which stage you start at. So, like, Tempest, you can start from, you know, the very beginning and it's easy, or you can jump ahead to, like, Zone 12 and it's, you know, you drop in your quarter and then all of a sudden you don't have a quarter anymore and you're, you know, feeling sad. Yeah, I don't know that there was like this freeform stage select in any game before this, but I never want to say there wasn't, because there's always going to be some esoteric thing that five people have played. And those five people will get so mad at you and make such a snarky remark on your YouTube channel. So just never proclaim anything the first. Say one of the first. This was one of the first for sure.
I love the nonlinear approach to the levels. I think figuring out the Robot Master weaknesses, it was like a bit of a puzzle in of itself. I feel like the classic series kind of lost the plot a bit, and like it was too unpredictable to figure out what the weaknesses were in later games. But the first one, I think it made sense the most.
It's reasonably logical in the first game, right? Like bombs to blow up Gutsman, who's based around big boulders that you blow up with dynamite. Fireman, Iceman, yeah, sure, you know. that makes sense. And then you cut man for elect man for cutting wires in a way, maybe. Like that all is reasonably logical. But I do feel like there's also that element of in the later games, of course, when there are more bosses, two more bosses in fact, to make a whole eight. There is also that aspect of the playground. Oh, I found out that you can use this guy on this guy. So that comes down through, not through osmosis, but through the sort of hubbub. And honestly, the original Mega Man beating some of those bosses with just the Buster is horrendous for me. So,
I would not recommend ever starting with Elec Man or Iceman. That just seems like a terrible idea.
Well, there is a cheese strategy with Elec Man with just Mega Buster, but...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you can kind of gate him into a pattern, but it requires very precise like forwards movement the moment battle initiates and firing your Buster shot and then letting him do his little dance and just locking him into a pattern. But it's, you only have one chance at it, and if that doesn't go through, then you're gonna die.
So it's an ADQ kind of thing.
Yeah, I will say, it is very much an 82 kind of thing. I just recently went through the Mega Man Legacy Collection, getting all the Steam achievements, and the final challenge was an all Robot Masters from 1 to 6 with just the Mega Buster, and I did it. don't recommend it. It took close to an hour to get through that gauntlet, but I did feel pretty good about being able to pull that off, so...
I guess at least right in the middle of it, you get Toadman as like a breather.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Toadman's a joke. Yeah. Mm.
I suppose for Mega Man 1, if you did beat Electman first, then the rest of the game is done. You just need to use the pause trick and you're all right. Like, you don't have to worry about anything.
Oh, else. Exactly. Yeah. I'm a firm believer in the pause trick. It's not cheating.
It's completely acceptable to use the pause trick to get past the Yellow Devil.
Especially Yellow Devil, yes. Mm. I hate him.
I will say that I played that game enough that I can beat the Yellow Devil without the pause trick, but I don't know that that's a point of pride or just like, what did I do with my life? It's like the only muscle memory I have left. It's really sad. So we haven't really talked about like the basics of Mega Man, which maybe we don't need to do, but I still feel like we kind of, you know, just for the sake of this podcast, sort of explain how the platformer works. So yes, we talked about different weapons. We talked about bosses. We talked about the level select, but fundamentally, like Mega Man is another one of those platform shooters. You play as a little guy who is a robot and his arm is a blaster cannon, kind of like Samus in Metroid, but you can start by shooting across the entire screen as opposed to like five steps in front of you. So advantage Mega Man. So Mega Man runs, jumps, he climbs ladders. You have to avoid falling onto spikes, which are the most powerful object in the universe and will instantly kill Mega Man. Otherwise, he, you know, takes damage from robots, but most attacks he can, you know, soak up like six or seven hits, except like Electman's attacks, he can soak up three and then he dies. But the thing about Mega Man is that his arm cannon is kind of basic. It just shoots three little beams straight across the screen, and you can't shoot in any other direction. So really, to have a fighting chance, you have to go defeat the bosses at the end of each stage. Each boss has its own special weapon and its own theme. And once you defeat that boss, you take its weapon and you can add that to your arsenal. So basically, at any point in the game, you can pause, go to a menu screen, and choose to swap between weapons. And the more weapons you have, the more versatile you become. Weapons, you know, that you steal from Robot Masters do have a limited power supply, so you need to find power-ups to refill those. But they expand not only your attack options, but also pretty much everything in the game is weak to one kind of Robot Master weapon or another. So sort of figuring out like, hey, this thing that's really difficult to defeat, I can switch to this other weapon and it'll take it out in a single shot. And that it also works for the Robot Masters. So, you know, like Electman is really fast and shoots this beam that flies really quickly across the screen and zaps out in three directions and hits Mega Man really, really hard. So he's really tough to defeat until you acquire Cutman's rolling cutter blade, which is like a little boomerang that sort of flies in a kind of like a loop toward the enemy and then back to you. And that will knock him on his ass, Electman, in three shots. So knowing that chain of weaknesses and which weapons work best in each space, each situation, even outside of Robot Master battles, is really kind of the key to success in Mega Man. And there's a lot of fun in just, you know, kind of exploring the game for the first time and trying different weapon strategies and saying, like, this weapon has a different, you know, firing pattern or, you know, different capabilities than my standard weapon. So figuring that out and then what is actually weak to it, it's a fun little game loop. And, you know, on top of the fact that you can select any of six levels to start with and play them in just about any order, really adds to the replay value of Mega Man. And also it has really tight controls, very precise gameplay. There are some frustrations, like really bad knockback when Mega Man takes a hit. It'll knock him right off a platform. There's some glitchiness, like with the moving platforms in Iceman stage where...
Oh, God, the worst.
Yeah, like through no fault of your own, just because of the way they're programmed, as they're moving up, you can actually clip through them and just fall to your death randomly, which really sucks. But, you know, aside from some rough patches, it's a really thoughtful and well-designed game. And
It's also the fact that, I mean, it's not used to its fullest extent, really, but the fact that the weapons and items that you find are used for traversal to some extent as well, not just the magnet beam, but also, you know, being able to pick up or destroy those giant bricks, or being able to freeze the flames in the pipes in Fireman's... Is it Fireman or Flame Man? They use both Fireman stage. It's just little things where, as with the robot master orders making some logical sense, there's some, again, logic to the fact of thinking, well, I have an ice weapon, maybe I can freeze this. Oh, I can, that's cool. I do like stuff like that. And I even though it's very formative here, it's still welcome. And it's not like the game is... You know, it has a sort of a reputation for being difficult, but it's, I mean, the enemies will randomly drop, like, more or less full health refills. I don't think it's ungenerous. It gives you what you need to beat the game. Yeah. And the difficulty curve being, I would say the general stages are maybe pitched a hair above average difficulty, and then the final stage is a hair above that. I've never felt like it's completely, at any point, nails unreasonable. There's some stuff in the final... in the Wily stages that's a bit more slapdash, like some of the boss fights, but mostly it's just kind of a chill time at the... I was about to say chill time at the movies, but it's not a movie, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I think the magnet beam served that as a great band-aid if you were really failing hard at some of those tricky platforming segments. Just shoot the magnet beam a couple times, create your own ledges, and move forward and get it over with. So I appreciated that. I in my recent replay, I learned to really adore the magnet beam.
Yeah, that's one of those things. Like, I think it's fun to try to beat the Yellow Devil without the pause trick, and, you know, try to use my residual Twitch skills from when I was younger. But, you know, I've done Mega Man without using the magnet beam, without relying on it, getting through the vanishing blocks and the platforms and Iceman stage that are floating around and shooting at you. I've done that legitimately, and it's not actually fun. So I have no compunctions about just, you know, laying out that magnet beam and running past all that crap. Same with the vanishing platform section in Heat Man stage in Mega Man 2. Like,
yeah.
You know, sometimes there's some stuff, it is just... it's too much bullshit, and I don't have enough time for that in my life. So I'm okay with saying, you know what? So long.
They gave you the abilities. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say about the disappearing blocks. I don't really mind them in Iceman's stage because they're not over a bottomless pit. In Heatman's stage, not only are they over a bottomless pit, but they also do that thing where one of them appears directly above the one you're standing on and leaves you no clearance to jump on it, which is really... there's nothing more that can be said about that other than swearing. And they do like to do that trick throughout the whole Mega Man series. But yeah, because you have items 1, 2, and 3, it's not like you don't have options, which is what the Mega Man games have always been pretty much impeccable at doing, is giving you options.
Yeah.
I like how we're kind of jumping ahead here, but I like how in Heat Man stage, you know, they know you're going to use item 2 to just sail past that gulf, you know, the flame and the empty pit.
Yep.
With the infinite cascade of disappearing blocks above it. So in the middle, they stick a 1-up and you're like, ooh, I want that. And the first time you get through there, you're sailing past, you get the 1-up, and then you land and you realize, oh, there's still more of this shit. And I don't have enough juice in my item 2 anymore. I should not have jumped off because I wasted power. And you actually cannot have enough power in item 2, even if it's full when you start, to sail across the lava, get the 1-up, and then sail across the chasm. So you have to like deal with the rest of it on foot, which sucks. So it's, you know, one of those little traps. It'll get the novice. I guess if you're really cool, you can like jump out there over the lava, get the 1-up, and then sail across on item 2, or even just deal with the blocks again. But why would you do that? It's not like that game is shy about giving you 1-ups unless you play like quote-unquote hard version, which is, you know, the standard Japanese difficulty.
I feel like those kind of lures, maybe it wasn't Fujiwara, but I like to think it was Fujiwara being like, stick a 1-up in there, trick the player.
So any other thoughts on Mega Man?
I will say, I like that you mentioned the use of the Robot Master weapons and how they really help with traversing through the stages. And, you know, it's not just about the Robot Master weakness, but the weaknesses of the common enemies. I jumped into NES Mega Man games way too late. I started with the Anniversary Collection on PS2. And by that point, I had first played X on SNES and 7 on SNES. And maybe it's because of...
You got started with the best and the worst. That's quite a spread.
And I think X, I became so reliant on the X Buster that when I played the NES ones, I'm like, oh, I want to save all the Robot Master weapons for the boss because I don't want to have any run out by the time I get there. And it's only recent years where I just learned to accept that if you use the Robot Master weapons during the stage, enemies will drop, recovery items to fill that back up by the time you reach the end boss. So it took a lot of like reconditioning on my end to just accept that and not stick to Mega Buster the whole time, because you're just going to have a bad time getting through those stages if you're not using all the tools at your disposal. So
yeah, I feel like the power-ups, the refill icons are pretty generous. And I kind of look at using the Robot Master weapon resource in Mega Man games the way I do using consumable items in RPGs. Like, you can always get more. And why not make the game a little easier for yourself and just, you know, make use of the tools you have at hand? I think playing roguelikes kind of got me over the hump of holding on to items too long. And you use the same strategy in Mega Man and you realize like, oh, there's a lot of variety and a lot of options to how you play this. And it can really, you know, make things a lot easier or a lot harder depending on how effectively you use the Robot Master weapons.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess breakable weapons in Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom kind of are good recent examples of just use the tools.
Mm-hmm.
Don't cling on to them.
So that's Mega Man. Now it's on to Tokoro Fujiwara's next game, Ghouls and Ghosts, which apparently you're both big fans of. So I'm going to let you regale the audience with tales of its wonders.
I feel like it's just Ghosts and Goblins, but like good for me. There's a lot, I think, of focus on... I don't want to say environmental storytelling, but in the first game, it feels like you're moving through kind of like really kind of extreme abstractions. And in this game, I feel like every stage is memorable. Every stage is very different and shows you something different and cool. Just use the second stage as an example. The fact that you've got like initially these giant bouncing turtle things that not only, well, they sort of bounce towards you in sort of in an arc, but sometimes they'll land, their hands and their heads and their legs will pop out and they'll start walking towards you. You've got windmills, and initially you're like, oh, cool, a windmill. Then later there's a windmill that's on fire and the blades of the windmill are a hazard. Then you go even further in and everything's on fire. And it does feel like you're journeying through. It's like, I don't think we mentioned it, but it's like, you know, the map screen from Ghosts and Goblins, the map screen from Ghouls and Ghosts. They're both communicating that you are journeying through a world, but I think that Ghouls and Ghosts is better at doing that in the actual stages. The way that the checkpoints are placed as well always is very satisfying, I think, because generally the stuff you see after a checkpoint in a stage is not the same stuff that you've been seeing previously. It's very good at shaking things up without throwing something at you that you just can't deal with. It's still very difficult, but it's not as difficult because you have access to, you can fire upwards for a start, and you'll need to because there are more sort of airborne enemies like the vultures. I think this is the one that introduces magic as well. if you are able to get the more powerful armor, and there are more power-ups as well. This is the one that introduces, I think, the chests bursting out of the ground when you go to certain sort of hotspots on the screen. And if you're lucky, you'll get a decent weapon like the daggers, or if you're unlucky, you'll get the water, but even that's not as bad in this one. And the spectacle is fantastic. The giant boss fights are just really well drawn, really cool. The first one with the sort of monstrous warrior that pulls its head off and then brandishes the head at you, which then breathes fire. It's just rad. It's just a rad game. While it is very difficult, I always feel like if I die in this game, which I do, I always think, oh, I see where I screwed up there. I don't think that's bullshit. I mean, it often is bullshit, but the fact that they tricked me into not thinking it is bullshit is nice. There's a lot of just cool set pieces that make it stand out and make me want to go back to it a lot. I love this game. It's one of my favorite Capcom games.
So I'm more partial to Super, but I've only played through and finished the original Ghouls and Ghosts once. But I found it, like, I think it's the easiest, perhaps, of any of the games. I don't know.
I think I would agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, and part of me is like, is this easy and Ghosts and Goblins ever go hand in hand? I think not. But I think, yeah, it kind of throws you a bone more in this one. And I think the suit power-ups are a plus. And the stage design just feels more, like, fair, I guess. It's one way to put it. But yeah, like... I finished it in one sitting, and I just came away feeling like that was a satisfying playthrough. Like I didn't agonize for too long on any one individual stage. So yeah, so kudos to the game for that. I think if there's one G&G game to recommend for, you know, someone who's doesn't want to have like an incredibly bad time, then I think Ghouls and Ghosts is the one.
If it's okay to do this, I want to compare it to Super real briefly, because obviously Super introduces a double jump, but also the double jump is another committed jump. And what it means ultimately is not, yes, you have a way to recover. It's, we have design platforming that requires this, except you have to do it twice. Also, Super, you can't fire up or down, I believe. They've taken it straight back to left and right. So yes, I would say Ghouls is the most... I don't know what the correct word is. Like, you have the most options for what direction you can fire any given time. If you need to, you can jump in the air and fire downwards, which you do need to do to kill some of the enemies, some of the bosses. And yeah, it's still rough, but you can do a lot more damage from a lot more different angles. You're not completely locked in terms of strategy. And, you know, I love Super. I honestly, as much as I love Ghouls, Super Ghouls is marvelous. Like, it's absolutely marvelous. And on another day, I might say that was my favorite. It probably still is. I don't know. But this one is just, they got everything right. Like, the music, the visuals are so cool. The enemies look so much more detailed than in Ghosts. I love the little, like, Grim Reaper guys that poke their heads out of the, like, the reeds and look around, like, hey, 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 where is he? You've got, like, the guillotines on the first stage. It's just such a cool obstacle, a freaking guillotine, you know? but honestly, I could just sit here and list cool things in every single level of that game. But I won't. Maybe I'll do that for a future episode. Stuart Jip just lists things that happen in games. That would be good.
So are we talking here, are the two of you talking about the arcade version or the Genesis Mega Drive version?
Honestly, they're very close, I think. The Mega Drive version is very, very close.
Yeah.
It is, but it has much less forgiving hitboxes. There was I looked at this. I tried to find this when I did my, say, Gaiden episode on this game, and I cannot find where it was, but someone created a GIF that showed comparisons between the arcade Genesis and PC or Super Graphics version of Ghouls and Ghosts, and by far the Sega Genesis version has like the most hilariously enormous hitbox on Arthur. So you'll like take damage from things that aren't even close to hitting him. So know, it makes it really hard.
I know what you're talking about. I thought it was the TurboGrafx or PC Engine one that was the most unforgiving, but I'd have to look it up again. But all I know is that
I recall it being the Genesis version.
It was Genesis. Okay. Yeah. It's definitely a home port. That's way more unfair. And I played the arcade version and I had a smooth sailing experience, as far as smooth sailing can go with Ghosts and Goblins. Sure. But that was the version that I came away with feeling very satisfied having played it.
It was Mega Drive for me initially, but honestly, if I play it now, it's going to be the arcade version. I think I spent the most time on like the Capcom Classics collection version of it, or the Capcom Generations version, and I haven't played the Mega Drive one for a long time, and honestly I can't think when I would again having access to that. But I know that that port was, I mean, I feel like it was complete. Like, it really does feel like playing the arcade game. Any hitbox issues, I can't recall. But if I were to play it, for example, after this, which I probably will do to see how I feel about it, I will come to you and I will private message you and I will say, you were right, Jeremy Parrish. You were right about the hitboxes.
No, I don't think you should private message me. I think you should declare it publicly.
Okay, I will.
Yeah, that's how you should.
I'll post it on Blue Sky. I'll tag you in.
Thank you.
And I'll do it as like an apology video.
Now, if I'm wrong, that you can send that as a private message. That's fine.
Okay.
So one final bit of trivia about the Genesis Mega Drive version of Ghouls and Ghosts is that Sonic the Hedgehog would not exist without Ghouls and Ghosts, because Yuji Naka programmed the home port, and that was where he learned to deal with diagonal ground, which was a fundamental element of Sonic and the speed loops. So Capcom basically invented Sonic. Who knew?
Huh.
Oh, man. Son of a bitch. No, wait. Let me try that again. Son of a bitch.
Ah, there we go.
Very poor.
Love it.
So, hey, you know what we're not going to be able to do this episode? That's right, get through the entire list of games that I have here. But that's okay, because we're taking our time. We downshifted to first gear. We're sauntering slowly and enjoying our time here in the world of Capcom platformers. And what, I mean, gosh, we're in some great times right here. Mega Man 2, holy crap, what a cool-ass game.
You know, somehow I had a negative experience my first time playing Mega Man 2 in the Anniversary Collection. But again, this is
Did you play on GameCube? Because Mega Man experience in the GameCube Anniversary Collection was a miserable experience.
Oh, yeah, because of the B and A swap. Yes. No, I played the PS2 version, which I think came out prior to the Xbox and GameCube versions. But again, this is me coming as an X fan and having only played Mega Man 7 prior, but I guess I was latched onto the idea that if you're hanging on a ladder and you pause the game and you unpause, that Mega Man would stay on it and not zip through into the spikes below, doing his teleportation. I think it was mostly the Wily stages that gave me grief the first time.
Are you talking about the place where you're kind of like dropping and there's moving platforms that are above spikes and there's the little can guys who home in on you?
Yeah.
Oh, Telly.
I would teleport through the ladder after unpausing straight into the spikes, and I did not expect that. But it was not just that. It was I think the required mandatory crash bombs gave me the most grief.
The boo beam trap, everyone's favorite in the game.
That's the one thing that I'm going to be very jip about this now, and I apologize. The boo beam trap.
Do you know any other way, Stuart?
I've tried my best, and I'm undergoing extensive therapy for it, but I just can't stop. But I like the boo beam trap is like annoying. Like, it is annoying unless you know how to do it, and even if you do know, you might forget, which is my experience. But for Mega Man 2, for me, that is like the one thing that's even a blemish. And because I'm me, I kind of dig that it's there anyway. It's like the one thing that's just a middle finger is that one area. The rest of the game to me is just such a smooth and beautifully made experience. Like the difficulty level, I mean, I think it's low even for that, like, for that series, it's low, but it's perfect. It means you can just, like, blast through that game any old time and have a ball. All of the music is just fire. All of it. I love how different all the levels look. It's crazy how much of a glow up it is from the first game. And even, like, what was it, like, the next year?
Yes, in Japan it was, yeah.
Mm. And this was, like
exactly 1 year later.
And this was a game that was made as, like, a side project, right? It was, like, a sort of, well, let's stay in the office after hours and work on
it. I mean, that's kind of how it got started. But my understanding is that, like, they kind of kicked it off and put the planning together and, you know, started working on it and then presented what they had. And the management was like, oh, yeah, you guys should finish this. It's good.
It's brilliant. It's so much fun, like, even today. It's in a similar vein to Ghouls and Ghosts. Weirdly enough, I feel like it doesn't let one idea hang around for too long. It will throw something new at you, but again, without being like, okay, now the gameplay style has completely changed. It's all built around just the very few verbs that you have. I mean, I'm a proponent of Mega Man not having a charge shot, not having a slide. I don't think he needs it. I mean, I'm not going to kick off about it, like, on the internet or anything, but I don't think that that's necessary. And that's why I think they went back to that for 9 and it worked so well. When you have just those simple verbs and all you have to then do is come up with cool ways to use them. And this game had so many things that just stuck in my memory. A friend of mine had this as well, putting light to the idea that there were no NESs in England, because there were several in my city.
Was it actually a Dindy? Imported, smuggled from Russia.
I could have been. You know how memory is. But this is just the bomb. This is a great game. And it's still the best one of the classic series for me. I love some of the other games. But this one, like, compare it to, like, 3. I would throw 3 in the garbage every day and play this.
Oh, wow. You know,
it's just my opinion. It's still a fine game. Still just my opinion. I got nothing but superlatives to say about Mega Man 2. But, you know, I think everyone who's listening to Retronauts knows all about Mega Man 2. That's not to say don't discuss it, but that's how important it is. That's how iconic it is. It's one of, like, the main games of the 80s, basically.
Yeah, I did learn to appreciate it after the initial frustrations I had as a noob to it. But once I learned about the Metal Blade and that you should always just use Metal Blade... Yeah, I started to grasp it better and really appreciate it more. So, yeah.
You want to know something crazy about the Metal Blade? It's really effective, but the game is more fun if you don't just lean on it. If you treat it like the original Mega Man and just jump around to different weapons and find which weapon is, you know, most effective or hits the vulnerabilities of enemies best, it's really fun to, like, just, like, you know, figure out ways that you can cheese an enemy and take it out in one shot. Like, for those big jumping walker guys. You blow them up and then a little dude jumps out and starts shooting at you. Like, a single shot from the air cannon, the airman weapon, whatever it's called. That takes those things out in a single shot. It's awesome.
Yeah.
It is also fun as hell just metal blading everything in the face, though. Sorry. If I could do that in real life,
there's pleasure in that, too.
It's the diagonal
arc. There's some enemies
that are invulnerable
to metal blades, so then you got to... Yeah. You got to actually those giant walkers. The metal blade just bounces off.
Oh yeah, that bounce is very deflated, a deflating feeling. It's like, oh crap, you really can't use this.
Oh no, I have to use a strategy.
Exactly.
I use the strategy, metal blade, and just don't go on the ground where they are. Stay above them, and then you don't have to deal with them at all. It's great.
I think to this day, I'm still terrible at the initial platforming segments of Airman stage with the spikes on the edges of those weird looking faces. I can never quite get those jumps right, even to this day.
I like to flex on them by standing on one pixel of the edge while the drills are out.
Oh man, living on the edge.
And just stand there going like, yeah, you can't touch me. With those guys, you're right, Jeremy, of course. I kid about the Metal Blade. It is fun to use it, but also, like, when you're dealing with those things, that's where you pull out the leaf shield, you know, so the things that fly out the side can't hit you while you're trying to concentrate on platforming. It really does feel like the weapons have been just, like, crafted in a way that they're all fun to use, which I cannot say about many of the other Mega Man games. They just feel like they're there a lot of the time. But in Mega Man 2, they're all situationally very useful.
Yeah, I would say the only dud in the lineup is the Heat Man weapon. atomic fire, which is cool in theory. You can charge it up and like blast things with it. But the actual process of charging is not as satisfying and effective as, you know, once you get the Mega Buster in Mega Man 3 or 4. So it's kind of a dud. Like, I never use it until, you know, I get to Dr. Wily's his capsule and blow the front off of it with the atomic fire. But other than that, it's kind of a waste. But everything else, awesome.
I think I use it on Heatman. No, not Heatman. Woodman. I think I can kill him in like 2 shots if you fully charge it. But then I think you can just metal blade him anyway.
Yeah, you have to get it between his leaf shield, which there's a very small window for that.
Yeah,
and it's really,
really
frustrating to charge up a full atomic fire and then miss the window by like a frame and just have it bounce away because it's deflected by a leaf. No, leaf does not deflect a ball of like solar flame. I'm sorry. That is not how this universe works. Bad Mega Man 2.
My favorite revelation recently in my replay has been that Airman's weapon is pretty good with Woodman and going through the leaf shield. That was pretty cool to find out. And so you have to get it like the timing just right to blast through his leaf shield with it. But it's a good alternative to.
Also, you use Woodman's leaf shield to take down Airman. So, you know, it's a chicken or egg situation.
Yeah.
I think Airman, I just spam the Mega Buster and you can kill him in a damage race usually. Which is why the song I Can't Beat Airman always confused me. It's one of the easiest guys.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's because the game sort of defaults you there. Like, it's the easiest stage to start with if you just kind of like go with what's sort of presented to you. And it is a little challenging. And, you know, if you're not used to Mega Man, which why would you be? Because this was only the second game and no one played the first. You know, facing a boss who deflects all your shots and jumps forward and hits you with, you know, all those tornadoes, like that's tricky. That's challenging. It's intense. So I can
it's
see where it's like
an
initial trauma sort of thing. But yeah, he's not actually that hard.
Still hate those little mini tornadoes, though.
They suck. Tornadoes should not be able to deflect all forms of fire. No.
Yeah.
To me, the actual MVP weapon, besides obviously Metal Blade, the most fun to use is Quick Boomerang. Because it's really fast. You can auto fire it. It doesn't use much ammunition. You get like 5 or 6 shots per tick of the power bar. So there's just tons of them. And also you get to run around in like this hot pink. It's like super late 1980s, very vaporwave. it's just a great little setup.
Great against those frogs too. The quick boomerang.
So. Goddamn frogs, yes.
Yep. And then to get the quick boomerang, you got to get through those beams, which means you got to stop time, which is also dope. I just thought I'd add that. Well, actually, you don't have to stop time. You could be good at it, but like,
yeah,
that's my other muscle memory from when I was a kid. I can still get through the quick beam traps.
Yeah,
Anything else, I'm like, I have no dexterity. I'm useless.
Yeah, once again, the Legacy Collection challenges helped me. Do all of those segments without the flash weapon, and they're totally doable without. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's all knowing which directions to hold as you're falling off into the next screen and all that, and positioning. So
yeah, it's just pure memorization, and you know, getting through that, mastering that, prepare me to play Battletoads a few years later. So it all
oh god,
pay it forward.
The only thing I can condemn about the quick beams is that and I'm sorry to jump this far ahead, but I've got PTSD, is when they brought them back for Mega Man X5, but also now you can accidentally cling to walls.
Yes, that is some shit. I hate
it was some shit. Quite so. Like, literally.
That's where you use Darkhold. Yeah.
Yeah, I complained about that. I berated that in my review for my website back when the game first came out. So like dozens of people saw me express that opinion in the year 2000. I think we maybe have time for one, possibly two more games. So let's do that. Let's talk about DuckTales. And I'm not going to say too much about DuckTales because we recently had a mailbag episode about licensed NES games. And everyone talked about how much they love DuckTales. You were there, Stuart. You remember.
I think we
talked a lot about DuckTales for NES.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that it's difficult for me to go more than about 3 episodes without mentioning DuckTales for the NES. It's that good. It is that excellent. It is probably up there with Mega Man 2 in terms of impact it had on NES players. And not to mention it's a licensed game. It may be the first great cartoon licensed game. Because I'm telling you that Scooby and Scrappy-Doo on the Spectrum was not as good. Not to mention Count Duckula, No Sax Please were British. yeah, I mean, everyone knows DuckTales. It's great. It's not only a fun game. It doesn't only introduce the whole choose your level system from the Mega Man games, really, but also with something of a semi-Metroidvania-ish kind of, you can't get through this level yet, you have to go to the other level first to get this item. It's completely laced with secrets, but also on top of that, introduces a whole new method of traversal that's also your attack and is really, really fun to master, which is the pogo stick, obviously. Mm. I got nothing bad to say about DuckTales whatsoever, except for pressing down and the button to do it is not as good as just pressing the button like in DuckTales 2. Your mileage may vary on that one, though.
Yeah, agreed on that. Pogoing was very satisfying. Honestly, that's all I can think of usually with DuckTales is just how fun the pogo maneuver is and the fact that you can use it to traverse through spikes and things like that. Big ups on that.
I just love bouncing over into like the HUD over the level, like sort of like finding a warp zone in Super Mario Brothers, you know.
Yeah, it's very much the same. Like, oh, you broke the boundaries of the stage, and actually, there's really cool stuff out here. Good job, you can find some secrets. Here's some money for you.
It always makes you feel very cool when you find something like that. I was recently playing Shovel Knight again because Mina the Hollower came out, and they borrowed that for Shovel Knight in some places, and I just found myself thinking, you know, that actually still makes me feel really happy. Even now, jaded as I am, being able to go over the HUD and it turned out to be not a glitch, they did it on purpose, that's always very satisfying.
About the only knock I can give on DuckTales is the finale where you have to climb to the top. I remember losing there because my first time playing and finishing the game on a stream right as DuckTales Remastered was coming out and not realizing that not making it in time before the other I forget the name of the duck that's
Glamgold
is trying to reach the top. If you don't make it first, that's like a life lost, and I ended up using up all my continues and failing there.
Isn't that only in the remake, though? I'm sorry if I'm being rude by pointing this out, but I thought that was only in the remaster, the chase scene at the end. I thought Wafer would put that in because they were being cheeky.
I could have recalled there was like a climb up to something. Was that only in the remake?
Because I thought Dracula Duck was the end of the original, and I hate pointing things like this out because it feels like I'm being mean.
I'm
almost certain that was only in remaster because I remember everyone, including me, complaining about how mean it was.
There were some mean moments in the finale of Remastered, yeah. Again, this is where the cobwebs in my brain are starting to show, and I can't recall what went on in the finale now.
Well, it was so awful that it went back in time. I mean, if I can knock down DuckTales on anything at all, I guess, in a sense, revisiting Transylvania for the finale is not that inspired, but also it's kind of cool because it's like you've solved a mystery and now you know where to go to fight the final boss, and it's somewhere you've already been, but there's like a new dimension to it now. I do like that a lot. Other than that, nah, it's pretty much perfectly formed, I think. It's just the right length. It's not, you know, not too long, not too short, and it's got the moon theme in it.
Okay, I had to verify this. The moon theme, first off. Fun fact about the moon theme is most covers and arrangements of it get the first couple of notes wrong. There's like a specific time signature to them, and it became a bit of a meme among video game music aficionados that whether an arranger gets the time signature correct, there's like one shorter note than what most people play of the moon theme, and I find that kind of funny. I had to look up a long play of DuckTales, but there is like this climbing rope section at the tail end, and I think it's that green colored duck is being carried by the Madame bird duck. I'm describing these awfully, but you have to reach it like a treasure chest at the top.
Yes, I do vaguely remember that now.
Yeah, and if you don't reach it in time, that's a life lost, and that's where I got my game over. And I didn't rage quit though. I sauntered on and I tried again, and yeah, good times.
Okay, so I like, you know, a nice 90-minute to 2-hour podcast. We could do one more or two more. Let's talk about Buster Brothers, which is not actually a Capcom game. They published it, and you know, they are very closely affiliated with it. It was actually designed by Mitchell, Mama Mitchell. So it's a game about Jodan Baker, I think, breaking bubbles. Is that correct?
I think it's bubbles, yeah. I never played the original, only the SNES.
Is this Pang?
It is Pang, yes.
Okay.
Buster right. Brothers. So Buster Brothers, you know, is kind of, I guess, Capcom publishing a game that goes back to the game style that predates Sun, really. Like single screen arcade action games. It's kind of a shooter, kind of not. You are a guy with like a wire, a grappling wire, kind of like Bionic Commando. But instead of grappling around, you just run around the bottom of the screen, throwing up your wire and trying to break bubbles, and they break into smaller bubbles and you have to destroy all of them. So kind of Asteroids-ish. It's not really a platformer, but it feels like it belongs to that same sort of universe of game design as Bubble Bobble. Not just for the bubbles, but also just for the overall single screen action ethos and dual player design. So yeah. It kind of feels sympathetic to a platformer. It's a strange little game, not a puzzle game, it's just like a classic arcade game that they said, you know, the year 1989 is a great time to release a game that would have been awesome in 1982.
I feel like in a way it's an iteration on Space Invaders, because certainly initially I think you can only fire one wire on screen at a time until it touches the top of the screen or hits a bubble, which is much like with the Space Invaders, you know, mm-hmm. where the way that they split in and the better, so in theory, the better you play, the more difficult it is to dodge the enemy's sort of air quotes shots is really interesting, because it means there is strategy there. You can't just, like, you think you can just kind of go like hog wild and hit one like a bunch of times at the beginning, but you're just going to be dodging a lot of much smaller but no less deadly balls. Now, this has got like ladders and platforms in, right? I mean, there's bricks you can break to get power-ups and things, so it's like a big mashup of about 10 different arcade games. But I mean, it had some legs. They made a few sequels to this, I'm fairly sure.
Yes.
And I do like ideas such as there's a power-up that makes your wire turn into like a wall almost, and it stays in place until one of the bombs hits it, and then it will disappear and break the bomb. I just think this is a game that has a lot of really interesting sort of in-the-moment strategic things you can do, or quick things you have to quickly react to and think, will this help me or will this actually hinder me further? Because there's kind of physics involved as well, to some extent, with the bouncing bubbles. But it's hard for me to deem it a platformer, because not only do you not jump, but you also don't really grapple, or your feet don't leave the ground at any point unless you're falling. So I suppose in a way it is a bit... It's like Chucky Egg, except you can't jump.
Yeah, like I said, this isn't really a platformer, but it just feels like it's... It has some resonance with that genre, so that's why I classed it here, lumped it in here. But that's not totally accurate. I don't know. It just seems like someone needs to acknowledge that the series exists, and where else to do that but in a podcast about things that are kind of a little spiritually like it, but not exactly the same. That's sort of weak justification. Oh, well.
Yeah. And this is 1989, right? Mm-hmm. This is the year after the Phil Collins movie Buster, but it has nothing to do with that. I just want to make that
no,
very clear.
Buster did not actually have a brother. Mm-hmm. He did have a wife, but it's not Buster family.
I wish that it had been based on that movie. And you played
Phil
Collins.
Like, you're trying to steal gold. There'd be a train level. It'd be great.
Yeah.
You could fight through Acapulco.
I just feel like Phil Collins deserves a game. That's all, really.
I mean, there was Vice City Stories.
True. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I forgot he was in that. Very true.
He was. Yep.
You know that it's not much of a platformer when I end up steering the conversation to be about Phil Collins. I do apologize. I've been asked to stop doing that.
I feel like every day should be a celebration of Phil Collins, if we're being honest.
Oh, hell yeah.
Did you know that we are recording this on the 40th anniversary of Invisible Touch, Genesis album sung on by Phil Collins? Okay, sorry.
Which is based around the hitboxes in the Mega Drive version of Ghouls and Ghosts. Yes, hello.
That's right. Hey, you got it. Got it in one.
I just wanted to say, if we wanted to make one more Phil Collins video game connection, Double Dragon 2's second stage completely rips off Easy Lover.
Oh, that's true. Huh. Yeah. Collins, yeah.
So there's that. I did not remember that, but I...
Also, Sega Genesis, that's, you know...
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, wow. I unfortunately have not much to say about Buster Bros. When I worked at Capcom, we had a Super Buster Brothers cartridge in the closet, and I checked it out once and didn't really think much. The shooting upwards kind of made me think of Donkey Kong 3, and I don't have positive things to say about Donkey Kong 3, but that's the only...
That's one of the 10 games that it's based on, yes.
Yeah.
Stanley's all right. Yeah, I mean, I had, for some reason, I don't remember buying it, but I definitely had a Buster Brothers compilation on the PS1, where there was like three of these games on there, which seems like such a... I feel like this game might have a bit more of a presence maybe in Europe, because this was definitely a microcomputer mainstay. Like, this was a very well-reviewed game on, like, Amiga and ST and stuff like that, as memory serves. And I did see this in a lot of arcades in the UK. And... given the nature of it, I think it's another one of those arcade games that's actually quite fair. It doesn't, I don't think it ever really pulls anything at you. It's just kind of like, here's what you're going to have to be dealing with, now deal with it. It's a quite methodical game again, but very much not a platformer, I would say. I will allow it, but it's part of the lineage, but for me, I just can't see it as that genre. I didn't even know Capcom... No, they didn't make this, did they? They just published it, you said.
Yeah, it's a publishing. Yeah.
Hence the Joe Don Baker joke.
Yes.
Okay, so we can't possibly end this platformer episode on a game that isn't really a platformer. So let's go on to the arcade version of Strider. We can talk about the NES version later. Strider, God, what a cool game. I've done episodes on Strider before, and every time it just degenerates to me saying, this game is so cool. But you know what? Yeah. This game is so cool.
It really is, yeah.
I'm wild that it came out in 1989. Like, just looking... So seeing it, seeing like the attract mode play at one of those barcades and, you know, just staring at it, I'm like, this came out in 89. Like, that was kind of a mind blowing, feeling.
No, that they had that at the front of the arcade in my shopping mall when it first came out. Like, you know, it was one of those arcades that just goes back and back and back. And it's like this dimly lit cave inside, full of video games. But then there were like, there was a space at the very front for one video game facing out into the hall. And for like 6 months, this was that game. You know, before this, it was Ninja Gaiden, because everyone walking past with their mom and dad loves to see a ninja getting a saw blade to the chest when the game is over. but they replaced it with this. And honestly, every time I saw it, I was like, I got to go over and put a quarter in because it's so cool. And this was right around the time that as Generation Xers did, I was hanging out with friends, and where was the third space we could most easily go to? Why, yes, it was the shopping mall. So we hung out there a lot, and I would buy Phil Collins tapes and play Strider. So, yes. You know, it all kind of comes full circle. But yeah, this game, no, like in 1989, seeing this in arcades, there just wasn't anything like this. And it was just so flashy and so self-confident. And every single sort of little action tableau is different, and they all flow together, and it just creates this seamless cinematic sense of action. Like, you are a cool cyborg ninja sword guy action hero fighting through the raddest set pieces. You're running down an exploding slope before fighting a robot gorilla and climbing up through electrical towers to a spaceship. And then you go fight robot dinosaurs in the Amazon.
Yeah.
Hell yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, the slope. Whenever I think Strider, I always think of that sloping part in the first level and just how impressive that looked.
I mean, this is another game like Ghosts and Goblins where I could just sit here and list cool things that happen. And honestly, the first 10 or 12 would be in the first level of the game. I have played this arcade. My main exposure to it was the Mega Drive port, which is really good, or at least I thought it was really good. I don't know exactly if it is perfect, but
no, the Mega Drive port is not perfect, but it's very close and very good.
The fact, like, everything from the beginning when you're like hang gliding over the cityscape and it just looks astonishing. The fact that you've got your little sidekicks, there's like a robot bird and there's the robot walker thing that follows you,
and a panther.
Yeah, I forgot about the panther. Sorry, panther.
I think you can have two walkers, a hawk and or falcon maybe, and a panther.
Yeah,
but all at the same time, it's so cool.
I mentioned it briefly when I talked about Bionic Commando, but I think this is the evolution of that, of the whole thing of like, no, not only can you climb the walls, you can also climb all over the ceilings, from mm-hmm. the ceiling up onto the wall, jump between walls. You know, it's not something I can think of seeing in a platform game before this, that level of athleticism.
Yeah, and then you fight the airship Gravity Core, and all of a sudden the floor is the ceiling, the floor, and you can cling to all of them and fly through space, and
And it has a strong narrative through it as well. But the thing that always comes to mind for me, really, because of course when I played this as a child, I didn't get super far. I could get to the second level, I think. I think the second level. I don't remember getting past that. But just the fact the first stage ends with a bunch of guys jumping into the middle of the screen and transforming into this kind of enormous communist millipede thing. I can't remember what its name was. It has a name.
Communist.
But the fact that you're standing on its back while it's flying around, climbing on this living thing. I'd never seen that before. Well, not, you know, slashing it in the face with this gigantic sword. It was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. It's still probably the coolest thing I've ever seen.
At one point you fight, you know, basically Ivan Drago, and he explodes.
Oh, yes.
And when he explodes, it causes the room that you're in to start collapsing into like fiery fragments. And you have to like avoid his explosion, but then duck to where he was standing to avoid the fiery fragments. Like, everything you do has a reaction, and it just constantly keeps you on your toes. It's so cool.
I said the most time I spent with this was the Mega Drive, but I had this on the Master System. I'd forgotten all about that. That version's not very good. I didn't recommend that one. And I also don't recommend the sequel that was on the Master System that's called Strider 2, that is in fact not Strider 2. It is not. It is not Strider 2 at all. This was a very big one.
It's up there with the Cyber Shinobi and games that I'm glad never came to the US.
Let's down there with the Cyber Shinobi, Jeremy. It's down there in the inside of a toilet with the Cyber Shinobi. This was another big one for Micros. This was a big game in Europe, which is why it got that sequel made in by Tyrtex, which is just horrible. the actual sequel, pretty good, but that wasn't for a while. It's just a wonderful take on the whole set piece rush thing. I think it's much less difficult than Ghosts and Goblins. It's quite feasible you could beat this game, I think.
I have a different experience of the difficulty. I played the PS1 version that came with Strider 2, where in America,
the one that was labeled Strider 2?
Yes.
Yeah, the disc 1.
You're like,
was
wow, this sequel
Strider
looks
1.
Exactly like the original game. That's so weird. What's
this
going on?
This is so derivative.
And disc 2 is Strider 2. Yeah, that was. And what's even funnier is when it came out as a PS1 classic on PS3, the discs were still incorrectly labeled.
Yeah, that confused the hell out of me because I didn't know about that. What the hell's going on?
So I played, I transferred that to my PSP and I played through the original Strider that way. I died so much in it that I question whether it was even doable to finish that game at the arcades, but I don't know if there was a difficulty difference in the PS1 version versus arcade. It just felt like impenetrable with the amount of stuff happening on screen.
I feel like it might be a case as well that I think if I played Strider like now on default difficulty, I'd have a reasonable shot of getting to level 4. But then again, that's how much of that is memorization. You know, it is a game that does kind of benefit from memorization. I don't think it's a super unfair game. But for example, like the mini boss towards the end of the first stage, I know where to crouch so that thing will never hit you. And that's just muscle memory. So I don't even think about it. You know, it's just in there. It's brain tape, as they'd say in Akewood. It's in there.
Yeah, I think this is one of those games. Also hallmarks of Tokuro Fujiwara design, visuals and aesthetics, that has that kind of random element component of Ghosts and Goblins, where like things are pretty consistent in terms of where they show up, but they have different behaviors every time you play. Like you never know exactly how something is going to act or react to you. You know, you get to the three Chinese dancer karate gymnast ladies at the the end of the airship. Sometimes you can just like walk in there and you're done, but sometimes they like go hog wild and they're jumping all over doing spin kicks. It's like you know, just going completely hog wild on you, and you know, it gets really challenging and you lose. So there is a lot of dynamism to how the game plays, and it's never exactly the same twice. It's very similar, but it always leaves you guessing just a little bit. And I think there are also difficulty settings in the arcade version so that things will be more tenacious or more likely to surprise you in, you know, shocking and unexpected ways.
I don't know if this was in the arcade version, but I remember playing the Master System one and having a lot of trouble with the time limit because they really made it scaled down so that you had to be not perfect, but pretty much perfect to get through some of the sections before the time limit would reset, like getting a time extend in the racing game. But I'm not sure if that was in the arcade as well.
Yeah, it's a challenging game, but it's worth just pumping those quarters into because it's, again, so cool. Like there are three arcade machines that I would actually own in my home. One of them being a Nintendo PlayChoice 10. The second being, I don't know, Mr. Driller G, maybe, I don't know. But the third would definitely be Strider.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You don't actually kill the villain at the end, right? I feel like it kind of just ends.
No, what happens is, I think he's like devoured by his own creations that he's summoned.
That's
you defeat
right.
him, and then he's like destroyed by the bizarre unlife that he's generated. Like he causes like weird, like piranhas and stuff to manifest in the air and fly around at you. And I think if I'm not mistaken, those end up destroying him.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's kind of like Darth Vader throwing the Emperor down the shaft of the Death Star. You know, undone by his own creation kind of thing.
For sure. And I have to also just mention the soundtrack real quick, because I think Junko Tamiya's score also did a lot of lifting and like creating the epic sense of everything going on screen, especially with the first stage.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did own that CD and I did listen to it a lot because it is like a film score, basically, the way they cut it and arranged it.
Yeah,
for sure. I think this is also one of the first collaborations Capcom did with like a manga publisher since, it was technically co-created hand-in-hand between Capcom and Moto Kikaku,
talk about that next episode.
Oh, snap. I just wanted to say I didn't realize it was a publisher and not a person.
I thought that too, but no, it is a publisher.
Yeah. Do we have to talk about that next
or like a collaboration? It's like a circle of collaborators.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, we're at our 2-hour limit, and I'm an old man, so I don't like to go on past 2 hours. So we're going to cut it off here, but we're at about the halfway mark of Capcom's platformer legacy, so we should reconvene soon and finish this off. There's some cool stuff to talk about, including this. I don't know if you can see this on the camera. You definitely can't see it on the podcast. This is... the linchpin of the Strider experience, the Strider manga by Moto Kikaku.
That's such a sick cover.
Yes, sorry,
the whole thing. It's like, it's just.
I can't read that.
Okay, sorry. It's cartoons. It's pictures. Look at those pictures. Look at that guy.
Was that ever localized?
No.
Is that the main Strider himself?
I believe that is Hiryu, yes.
Mm,
that's
cool. You can tell by the big bushy eyebrows and the hair. And there's Matic. The Matic. We'll talk about him next episode too. There's so much to talk about with Strider. And you know, we've already had a Strider episode, but tough nuts. I love Strider. We're going to talk about it some more, but this episode. We are done this episode. So this is a Retronauts bonus episode, a Patreon exclusive. So if you are a patron on Patreon, thank you for your support. I hope you have enjoyed this episode, and I hope you enjoy the second part that we are diving into soon. I don't need to tell you how you can support Retronauts or where you can find us, because you already have and do and will, and you're awesome. So thank you for making this episode possible. We made the best episode that we could just for you to say thank you. But I would be interested in hearing where we can find everyone who is posting or not posting, talking on this episode that is going to be posted on the internet or other places. Patrick, where can we find you and how can we support your work?
You can find me as PK Rockin. Yeah, that's an Earthbound reference. On B-Sky, Blue Sky, as well as Threads. And I also spearhead a Breath of Fire fan page across multiple social media platforms, and a Breath of Fire fan website called dragnear.net. So please check that out at some point.
Hmm. Interesting. So, Stuart, what about you?
You can hear me on Retronauts. You can buy my book, All Games Are Good. You can buy my other book, Nesbook. And I've just launched the games writing zine thing called The Oath. The first issue's out now, and the second one will be out very soon. And you can find that by going on my Blue Sky, where I'm plugging it all the time.
And you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, doing stuff on the internet all over the place here on Retronauts. But especially look for my cool video series called NES Works and Segaiden and Turbo Works. It's just a channel called Jeremy Parrish on YouTube, 1R in Parrish, and that's where you can find me. And I'm making videos, including videos about many of the games we've talked about. You can hear about them in greater depth and also look at pictures and videos and stuff. So it's more context for you that you can't get in a podcast. That's the special benefit that I offer to you with YouTube. Also, I'm on Blue Sky as Jay Parrish. Very exciting. Anyway, this has been Lucky Episode 777 of Retronauts. We'll be back on Monday with a full episode that hopefully will also still be lucky, even if it doesn't have such a fortuitous number. And again, with another bonus episode in 2 weeks. Look forward to it. Thank you.